This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, a show featuring Dialogue's Cora Perrigo and Paul McDougall, each with segments covering a wide range of topics from music to research to horror and the paranormal. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Cyrus Sunder Singh is an assistant professor at the University of Toronto and a Canada Research Fellow in Migration and Immigration. He's a musician, songwriter, poet, and filmmaker, and he's presenting his latest work, among others, at an event at CBU's Boardmore Theatre on Tuesday night at 7 o'clock called One Land, Two Hearts. Here's Paul McDougall of The Good Sentence.
So, Cyrus, you're coming down here in a couple of days' time to Cape Breton University to take part in a really interesting event. But before we get into that, I'd like you just to tell our close listeners something about yourself. And you're an assistant prof at U of T and a research fellow in migration and immigration. All fascinating stuff. And you work in various multimedia of all kinds. So how about just telling us about yourself?
First of all, thank you so much, Paul, for having me on the show. And here's the opening note.
I love it.
There you go. Okay, let that ring for a bit. So I'm coming to you from Toronto. In fact, downtown in the city. I'm just across the river from I'm on the west side of the Don River, and it is about. Let's see what it says. It's about 12 degrees today outside. So it's a beautiful fall day. It's November 1st. So happy first, everybody, and happy Diwali. Deepavali for those the festival lights for those who are celebrating that. I was born and raised in southern India, from a city called now called Chennai. And we arrived as immigrants to Toronto many, many decades ago. So that's I grew up here mostly. And one thing that I really wanted to always do, and I dreamed about doing, and I got to do it, and I continue to do it, is I always wanted to play music. So that was my first passion. And so I became a musician. I hit the road with a bunch of bands, including a bunch of reggae bands. I played. I hit the road, toured everywhere, played every little place, every little big bar and small bar, and all kinds of different places across the country, including in Sydney. I think that's as far as we got. I remember being in Sydney many times. And then playing all the small little towns like Sydney Mines and all this other ones up and down the Cape Breton coast. Mostly we would play at, what are those called? Those army places?
Oh, legions?
Legion halls. We would play legion halls.
Yeah.
And I remember that we would show up, it'd be like it'd be advertised as a 10-piece Reggie band. And we would show up and we'd be in the basement and they'd be playing bingo or something. And the moment we arrived, it was as if like we intervened, or like we interrupted something, the whole place would go silent.
Yeah.
And then it would be until like we start playing some music, and then we'd be sharing beers, and then we'd become the best of friends. So music was always a thing that that cemented everybody. So anyway, so music was my love, and I continue to do this. I'm a singer, songwriter, producer, performer. My main instrument is guitar. Now, as a solo musician and an independent artist, as they say, I put out a really good, critically acclaimed album called Sun to Star. Was touring it, lost a lot of money, ran out of cash because we're independent artists. So in a search for trying to find something, I fell into an opportunity to make films with the National Film Board of Canada, so the NFB. So I made my first documentary debut with them, called a film called Film Club, which was talked about arrivals of us when we were in grade 7 and 8. and about a little film club that we belong to, and it's still available. It's, you know, everything on the NFB is available free of charge. So anyway, so I became a filmmaker, which kept me in as a producer. So now I found that going from just music to films made it a bigger playground, a larger creative playground. So music was a part of this larger playground of visuals as well. So I became a filmmaker, producer, you know, again, remaining independent, and have been, you know, created a lot of films and mostly documentaries. I was known for documentaries. And my first film won a Gemini with the National Film Board. Mm-hmm. So it kept me in working, and that was the carrot. And then again, as an independent, where you're, you know, as an independent business, we have to invest in everything that we do, hoping that money comes back. And then at a certain point, I just hit the wall about 14 years in. So this was around 2014, 2013. And about just 11 years ago, 10 years ago, and in a panic, I said, I got to do something. I was like up the wazoo with debt. And I decided that I was either going to drive taxi or find something else. And then I made a left turn into a Master of Fine Arts at Toronto Metropolitan University in documentary media. Wow. So I'd already been doing documentary. So yeah, this allowed me an opportunity in. And so I spent 2 years of the two best years of my life, you know, not running left to right or right to left, but going down deep. I was able to kind of dig deep into the thing that I was actually doing that included music and performance and documentary, or filmmaking, or storytelling. And then I came out with this idea. I was able to unpack all the elements of storytelling and then bring it back together into a live performative setting, which meant that I came up with an idea called site-specific live documentary. So rather than see it on screen, I would invite the audience, and most of these were festival audiences, so film festival audiences. So rather than see it on screen, I would bring in the performer, I would bring in the subjects, the musicians, the narrators, everybody together. And rather than go to the camera, we would roll live.
Right.
So it becomes like an ephemeral ephemeral experience that once it's done, it's done. So it's like playing on stage, you know, you go in and do play a song, same song, but you play it to an audience, you have an experience, and then you move on. So this, in that same way.
This is the idea in your the film Brothers in the Kitchen, right?
Yes, yes. Thank you. That was my first. So that was also my MFA thesis project. It was at Hot Docs. It was a Hot Docs Film Festival world premiere. And we brought together, we entered into a cafe kitchen studio, and we brought all the, like, people bought tickets just like they would for a film, except this was live. So I brought in 13 subjects that were in the documentary. I brought in really good musicians. I brought in a chorus. I brought in, you know, professionals and the real people. The real people were not rehearsed. That's the other thing, is the real subjects who will be interviewed or speak are not rehearsed.
Yeah.
Right? And there's no way to edit or cut. And I give up that. It's about giving up that control as a director.
The person, right? The person that introduces in the very beginning of that film, that introduces it just before you, kind of go like, you know, start filming, says, kind of talks about that, and he says, and you never know when you're doing something like this, you may drop a few samosas on the floor. So I thought that
exactly.
was just a funny line.
Yeah, and he made that one up too. So
yeah.
That's what I'm saying, right? Like,
yeah.
That was the director of the festival, right?
Yeah.
And so this is what happens. So the idea is that you allow for things to happen in the moment that wouldn't otherwise happen if you had the full control.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Knowing that everything that happens is what's supposed to happen. So the idea is that there isn't anything wrong or right. It's just what is.
Yes.
So that was the philosophy behind what I was doing, because it goes back to playing music. It's like when you're on stage and you play, like one day my amp, which is a tube amp, a Fender tube amp, depending on the strength of the electricity, could either crap out or it could sound beautiful, mm-hmm. right? And yeah. then an hour later, it craps out again because it's too hot. So things happen, but it's all part of what it is. It's all part of the experience. And then if people are into it, it's a part of the experience. And part of the other thing about a live setting is that the audience knows when you're bullshitting.
Right.
And the bullshit meter is really there, right? And so they will let you know, even without speaking, they will let you know if you're being believed.
Yeah, right.
Right? Which is something that goes back to what we as humans do all the time when we gather and we, you know, tell stories, right? And we like the spinning, but we also know we can also tell when there's bullshit.
Yeah.
Right. So it actually helps to kind of keep the person that's kind of, you know, sharing their story a little bit on track. Right.
Yeah.
So that's part of what I was kind of academically also, you know, searching for and measuring as I was doing this. One of the reasons for doing this live stuff. But anyway, so that's what got me into that. And then the MFA then led to a PhD. A doctorate, which it's so between the MFA and the PhD, this was never part of my plan.
Yeah,
the brown kid from India was never thought of myself as a professor. In fact, I had a lot of difficulty with my teachers. I dropped out of programs. I did a lot of stuff. I even dropped out of high school, and so there's a lot of. Things that didn't work. So the last thing I ever wanted to be is a teacher. But about during the pandemic, you referenced the pandemic, you know, things happen. And then there was a call to me once from the department at Toronto Metropolitan. They said they had an emergency situation. They needed somebody to take a class, to teach a class. And could I do it? The call came on a Wednesday. I was really, really busy with launching one of the huge cross-Canada project, just like where we stand, and I'll come to that in a moment. And in a moment of, you know, nothing else, like not nothing else to do, but just like I didn't even think about it, I said, sure. And then 48 hours later, I was facing 200 black boxes on Zoom. But the most important thing is it comes back to the class that I was asked to teach was called Music and Film.
Nice.
How cool is that?
Yeah. Wow.
Right?
It's really cool.
So when I went in thinking, oh my God, I'm going to hate this, I came out so full, so pumped up and so full of energy and just thinking, oh my goodness, I'm ready for this.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us a little bit, since you're talking about music and film and that, you did this one called Footage, which is a great name. It's got about double, triple entendres to it. But it had to do with the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto, the 20th anniversary. But just give our coast listeners, we're here with Cyrus Sundar Singh, just so people know who's going to be in Cape Breton in a few days' time. But anyway, tell us a little bit about Footage, because that's a really neat little piece.
Okay, so Footage comes from, it was a piece that, so Footage premiered at the Bata Shoe Museum. In their window. So the Bata Shoe Museum is a building in downtown Toronto on University of Toronto campus. It's like right downtown, and it's at the corner of two main streets. So there's windows along east-west, and there's windows along north-south. Huge, huge windows. And every year they put a display there. The display changes every year. And for the 20th anniversary, which happened, I think, in 2015, they were also going to embed some screens, some TV screens in, and they wanted somebody to supply some content for it. At the same time, I was in my MFA program in one of the classes. We had talked about, it was a documentary class, and we were talking about, you know, having a set of rules to shoot something. Right? Like mm-hmm. people have had all these kind of different ideas of, you know, well, if we're going to do documentary, you know, it must be like real people. We can't use, you know, external music. It has to be real music. And there's all these different things that people would give themselves like a set of rules.
Yeah.
And then they'd go out and shoot it. Okay, so we were asked as an exercise to do that. So to fulfill that exercise, I went out one afternoon, and it was during the Easter parade. It was spring. It was the Easter parade, late March. And I decided to, actually, was it the Easter parade? No, it was, I know what it was. It was the Irish St. Patrick's Day parade.
Okay.
March 17th in Toronto.
Yeah, big parade.
And what I did was I had my cell phone with me, and I decided that I was going to give myself, so the restrictions was that I was going to shoot anything from wherever I was standing to 12 inches off the ground. And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was going to be the lens, and that's where the title footage comes from. It's 1 foot,
right? Yeah.
And so I wasn't going to be able to see the screen because I'm not like down on the ground, I'm standing. So I put it on a stick with a bunch of elastics, and I just shot whatever I think I could shoot.
Well, I tell you, for our listeners, this is a pretty cool film, and you wouldn't think that the simple technology you just described there, you know, like a selfie stick and a cell phone, a bunch of elastics would produce this neat little piece that you did, which can be found on the internet in different places.
This was even before selfie sticks. This was just a bamboo stick.
Oh, just the bamboo. Even better.
And a bunch of elastics.
Even better. Yeah, that's great.
And so the idea was that I would not, it would only be cuts.
Yeah.
That included sound, like there was only be cuts. There was nothing else. Like, I'm not going to add this or add that. It would just be whatever it was, and I would just cut. Anyway, so at the same time, the Battershoe was looking for something for content. They loved the title. I pitched it to them. So I ended up doing it over 4 seasons. So every season I would deliver like a 20-minute cut.
Yeah.
Whatever was happening in the season. So it would go from, you know, whether it was the St. Patrick's Day parade, whether it was the gay pride parade, then it was the Santa Claus parade, then it was the Easter parade. So I just used seasons as a way of doing it, and that's where it comes from. So thank you for asking.
Yeah, no, terrific. So listen, we have a few minutes left. I'd like to get to what's going down here, what's going on in CBU in a minute, but just give us you've been working on a new project with William Minogue of Christian Island. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Okay, great. So when I'm coming to, the reason I'm coming to Cape Breton is that I'm bringing a project called Where We Stand. The title comes from a series of consultations that I had with a whole bunch of Indigenous people from across the country, some of whom I've known, some of whom I was introduced to, for about a month, after which I sat down and I said, what if we had the opportunity to pair, to bring together an Indigenous participant who wants to do something with a non-Indigenous participant or a newcomer, and give them the opportunity, the resources, and the mentorship to create something new together. So that was the idea. So that's where the idea came from. And then through the consultations, the title came, which is Where We Stand, because all I kept hearing was that most of the theme that came out was the idea of land that is connected to identity and belonging.
Mm-hmm.
So young William Monet is one of the participants. He's from Beausoleil First Nation, which used to be known as Christian Island in Midland, Ontario. He is the son of, turns out he's the son of his father, who is a great painter. He's passed, and he was actually in a music video that I had way back decades ago. Anyway, so William is a musician and a producer, and he produced some music, and his partner was a graduate student by the name of Yanfei Lu, who came as a foreign student from China, and now she is a Canadian citizen as well. So they together, she's a dancer, so they brought together culturally and musically and creatively their two, you know, both of their skills, and they put together a piece that is also part of this. So the project brought together 8 sets of people through a selection process, And then we have now have eight pieces that we're going to be showcasing. And that is part of what brings me to Cape Breton. And one of the pieces that's being showcased is a piece by Andrea Curley, who's originally from Six Nations of the Grand Reserve. And she is working and is a resident of Cape Breton.
Yeah, that's and this is this event is called One Land, Two Hearts, correct?
Yes, it's called One Land, Two Hearts, yep. The Stories of where We Stand. So we're going to premiere it on Tuesday, November the 5th. That's in a couple of days.
Yeah.
At the Broadmoor Theater.
Yeah, Broadmoor Theater.
Broadmoor Theater.
And guess what? 9 out of 10 people that are new to Cape Breton or have not been there call it the Broadmoor. But that
I'm one of them.
Yes. You're in the majority there. So yeah, the Broadmoor Theater. That's Tuesday evening. Is it 7 p.m.? I believe.
At 7 p.m. Yes.
Yeah,
7 p.m.
And yes. So it's film, dance, music, poetry, storytelling. There's a whole bunch of things there. This is I'm just filling in our Coast listeners for this, and Cyrus Singh is going to be there as he described with his project. Light refreshments, I'm told, and the Broadmoor always provides nice light refreshments. I did a film thing there a couple of months ago, and it went over really well. It's a great place to see things, and this is a free admission. It's sponsored by the Center for Sound Communities. If you look Center for Sound Communities up on the net, you can find out more details about it. But Broadmoor Theater, Tuesday, 7 p.m., it sounds like a really great event, Cyrus. You're here for a few days, are you?
I am. I'm here for a few days, including Monday and Tuesday. And I'll also be at the university. I've been invited by Marcia, who is a professor there.
Yeah.
And I'm also now also a research chair with something called CERC in Migration. That stands for Canada Excellence in Research Chair in Migration. And that's who I'm a research chair with. And this is how we're doing this project. These cross-Canada projects are done with CERC in Migration.
Okay, listen, Cyrus, that's all great. I wish you the best of luck on your journey down here and how this whole event goes. I think it's going to be great. And it was wonderful talking to you, and hopefully I get to see you in person someday.
Thank you so much, Paul. Hope to see you and all your listeners there. And before I go, here's my final note.
Cora Perrigo has a post-Halloween special for you. She talks to Don Wells, host and creator of Creepy Cape Breton, available on Bell TV, as well as Amy McNeil, an investigator and researcher with PPRI, the Paranormal Phenomena Research and Investigation Group. She's also a content strategist at CBU.
I'm Don Wells. I'm a local film director, documentary filmmaker, ghost hunter, and I also am the creator of the series Creepy Cape Breton, that is available on Bell 5 TV 1.
Tell us more about Creepy Cape Breton.
Creepy Cape Breton, we're in the second season right now. We're still in the editing process, so we're still kind of been a little bit delayed on it. For right now, we actually are hopefully trying to work on other stuff like getting funding for some parts of the second part of the phase of editing, post-production. Well, I guess for this season, there's other things that we're trying to get a little bit more in there, like a little more stories than we did last time, and hopefully a continuation to one of our episodes, The Hat Man.
What got you inspired to create this series?
Well, I actually started long ago just through radio. I started doing ghost stories on radio. And from there, I just kind of just started doing my own thing eventually, because, I mean, I did have a background in film. So what I did was I decided I'm going to start making my own radio ghost stories. And I made some ghost stories just for Halloween specials. That's how it started out. And from there, I just kind of grew, and it just got more and more intense. And I just made it into, you know, YouTube videos. And I think once I started doing the stories on Number Two Ghosts and Hauntings, that's what kind of seemed to get a lot of reaction from a lot of people. And I figured, oh, well, maybe, you know, people seem to like Mi'kmaq ghost stories. So I started to continue doing that, because it seems to get, people seem to be very interested in Mi'kmaq ghost stories.
What do you think intrigues people so much about Mi'kmaq ghost stories?
I think because everybody heard it all. I mean, they heard of all the different places everywhere else. I mean, we all know that, you know, everyone knows about different parts of the world, their ghost stories, Salem, you know, haunted in Connecticut, and, you know, all these creepy places in all different parts of the world. But, you know, we don't realize this right here within our own, in the Maritimes, we have our own creepy legends, and they're never told. They were hidden for so long. And now it seems like they're starting to get a lot more attention these days, I'm noticing. And I think that's what it is.
What's your favorite local ghost story or story that you've covered?
You know, there's a few of them. Well, I mean, I'm still, some of the stuff that we have in legends, you know, I don't know all the legends for, you know, fully, but I know the basics. But I know that people have the encounters with Bigfoot, and we call them Googlies. And we have another name, people call them the Seskadel. And we will have another episode of that in Creepy Cape Breton as well. And there is a connection to that because of our legends, because the, you know, the giant orcs that hunt down people in the woods and would kill them. And they're big, hairy, cannibalistic giants. So that's something that kind of links. But thing is, everyone sees, a lot of people that see Bigfoot, you know, people that have, say they saw Bigfoot, Sasquatch, you know, it's just kind of strange how there's such a similarity in our legends to that goes all around the world to other people that have sightings of Bigfoot. And I guess another one I find very interesting is, I guess, the Chino. I never seen anyone have sightings of that, but I guess the Chino, it's a giant cannibalistic type of ice creature, and its mouth is all gnawed off from trying to eat its own skin. And this type of creature is, I guess it's similar to the Anishinaabe's Wendigo. Mm-hmm. So that would be the Mi'kmaq's Wendigo, would be the Chino. This one, that was kind of my favorite story, one of them, when I was younger, was about this woman who's, I guess, trying to be wooed by this guy, and she doesn't want to go with him. She doesn't want to be with him because he's apparently he's supposed to be this dark, evil medicine man, and I guess he uses black magic and all this. So she doesn't talk. She rejects him, and eventually, I guess, he gets kind of fed up with her rejecting him, and he puts a spell on her. But the spell he puts on her, I guess, has something to do with, they put like a snow in the spell on her neck or something, and eventually, I guess, when she wakes up, she starts to have all these urges to want to kill people, and she turns all vicious, and her appearance change, you know, to be haggard, and eventually she ends up having to, you know, basically just give up her life, you know, to be killed by the warriors in the village, you know, so she doesn't want to kill her family. Well, that will be a Chino, I guess. You know, there's different ways. There's different, people have different ways, or legends about it, and you can probably even just find them online, actually.
So was reading stories like that kind of what got you into hauntings and cryptids and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, not just my own legends, but other legends as well. You know, I looked at a lot of things growing up, and I was always into this. I mean, a lot of people say that, but I actually was really into this because it was the horror films, everything, you know. I just wanted to, I guess, share it with everyone else because I, you know, I seen a lot of stuff going on. There were events at the time. There wasn't a lot at the time, so I figured I'm going to create my own show and put it out there and just told those stories. And then eventually it just evolved into YouTube, and then it turned into a series eventually.
What was something that surprised you the most when filming the first season?
I'm not really shocked because a lot of the stories I pretty much knew, most of them, and I kind of let some people off. I said, oh, I'll get to you later, because at the time I never did the stories because it wasn't really, it was mostly for YouTube. But yeah, but I guess some of the ghost hunting, some of the stuff, you know, you capture and you didn't realize that you captured something, like certain voices you would hear. And, you know, I think, that's always the fun part. That's the fun part, just to go into that and to look at the evidence, what you find, if you hear any voices or you capture something. And for me, it's a little bit different because I'm alone. I don't have a big group of people ghost hunting with me. You know, it's more safer when you're with a group. But if you're just me with me and the camera person, the sound person that doesn't do ghost hunting, and you're the main person, you know, that's the way it usually is when I do these.
Is there a specific story you're the most excited about for the second season?
Okay, let me figure out a way to not give everything away.
No, yeah.
Well, I do have some stories on dark entities in the next season. So I will have a episode on dark entities this time. Well, I mean, we did have one with the Hat Man. There's going to be a part two as well. And we do have another story on the Googlers, on the Bigfoot. And I thought it was a very interesting story. I don't want to go too much into it, but it's a Mi'kmaq woman. She's an elder. And she shares an amazing story. And I think it's really... I think it's great when you hear stories from the elders. I think the elders always have the best ghost stories. So that's one of the ones I'm also pretty excited about. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot more encounters with Bigfoot than people realize. I mean, I actually had people send me footage on their sightings of Bigfoot. And I'm still debating what I'm going to use for the next this coming season. Like I said, we're still in the editing process. Deciding, you know, because there's a lot of people out there that are believers in Bigfoot and some people are not. And that's fine. It's, you know... Because you never know. Some people, maybe it could be a joke or something.
Yeah.
but the thing is, some of it is hard to debunk as well.
Do you, you said people were sending you footage. Do you encourage people to reach out to you if they have a strange phenomena you would like them to look into?
Yeah, I prefer it because it really helps to not just have the story. But if you have evidence or photographs, that's even better. And it makes the story a lot more interesting for me, too, because... I mean, you could tell us a story, you know, and it could be interesting as anything, but if you have some type of evidence, it makes it a lot more believable.
Yeah, so do you get a lot of your stories just through people reaching out to you?
Yeah, usually people reaching out to me and, you know, just talking to people too. Some people will just send me messages out of nowhere and just say, hey, look at this, you know, what is this? Or what do you think it is? Or you know, or they'll just tell me their experience. And some people have even just told me encounters, even when I did one on the aliens, UFOs. I had people send me their stories of abduction, actually. But they didn't want to talk about it. I mean, because I guess they're worried about being judged. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, so that's something I would love to cover more, though, because it will be nice to see those encounters. And, you know, but I do give people the option if they do want to go anonymous, you know, because, I mean, people, you know, we all have lives at the end of the day. We still have to continue on in life. And
more people than you'd expect have these stories where they have experienced these strange things, but they are so hesitant to talk about it because they don't want that judgment.
I think with ghosts, people are a little bit more open about it, though, because it's everywhere. I mean, everyone's into ghosts now, and so many people are even just going out and doing ghost hunting on their own. But but stories like Bigfoot or alien abduction, people kind of give you the weird look, you know. Or it's, you know, because I guess ghosts, it's a little bit more open, and people, I find more people believe than we realize, actually.
So I'm Amy McNeil. I currently work at Cape Breton University, where I am the content strategist. And I say that because my role at CBU does have to do with the presentation that I did called UFOs Have a PR Problem. And that's because what I do at CBU is, as content strategist, my main role is to run our website. I also work on other strategic content projects around the university, like our upcoming mobile app. And from a broader perspective, one of the things that I do for CBU is to take confusing, complex academic language, policies, procedures, and distill it down into something more simple, something that still makes sense, that still has the information that's needed, but isn't so confusing and academic. And that's something that I did with this presentation. And that's something that I felt there was a need for, because in this presentation, as I talk about, there is significant scientific, academic, and government resources and evidence that talk about the reality of the UFO and non-human intelligence phenomenon. And it's not really well known. And that's why I say that there is a PR problem. And I try to break that down in my presentation. It isn't well known, and I try to make it more accessible to the public.
So with your talk, the TEDx talk you did and the talk recently at the Paranormal Conference?
Yeah, the Cape Breton Paranormal Conference.
What is the PR problem?
Yeah, great question. So I actually named three different PR problems within the presentation. And the first problem is that scientific analysis is being done on actual pieces of UFOs, and scientific journal articles are being written about that. But because they're written in highly scientific and technical language, it's not widely accessible to the public, and it's also not widely known. I know from my role at CBU as content strategist that anything written above an eighth grade reading level is not widely accessible to the public at large. And these papers are written in a much higher grade level than that. So that's the first one, is that there is scientific analysis and evidence out there, but it isn't accessible to the general public. The second problem is what I call the entertainment problem. And that is that there, again, there is real, true scientific analysis, evidence, academic books written by credible authors, and highly credible government witnesses who have worked on UFO programs for, in particular, the American government, who we would term whistleblowers, who have come out with the information that they have. But much of this information is seen through an entertainment lens. And because of that, it is dismissed as purely entertainment when there is real, true academic value there. The third problem that I talk about is conflicting information from the governments. Throughout my presentation, I look at a number of different organized groups, again, particularly in the United States, that were gathered to investigate the phenomenon seriously. One of those is the UAPTF, so the Unidentified Anomalous Phenomenon Task Force. This task force operated until 2021, and in the reign of their time, they came up with 144 reports. They were only able to identify a single report as being identified. 143 of those reports went unidentified. After that report was submitted to the American Congress, the UAPTF was shuttered, and it was reformed into ARRO, Anomaly All Domain Resolution Office, I think it's called. And they put out a report in March of this year, March of 2024, saying that it was entirely American experimental aircraft. Everything that people were seeing out there wasn't UFOs. It wasn't anything to do with non-human intelligence. It was just them. It was American technology. That's just one quick example of something that doesn't make any sense at all. If it was American technology, wouldn't the UAPTF been able to have figured that out? Wouldn't they have been able to figure out more than a single case to identify within the realm of their work? It makes absolutely no sense. And it's something we've actually been seeing since, quite literally for decades, since after the 1947 Roswell crash, of which Project Blue Book is something that formed in response to the Roswell crash. The science advisor for Project Blue Book was somebody who's famous in the ufology world called J. Allen Hynek. And J. Allen Hynek says that Project Blue Book was initially a real scientific effort to study and analyze UFOs. As the project went on, he felt that the government was cherry-picking cases and ignoring others to suit its bottom line, that bottom line being that they always intended to interpret the information one way for themselves and one way for the public. And we're still seeing that today. I think the results that we got from the UAPTF in the early 2020s were as close as we've come to disclosure yet. And I think that the American government didn't look favorably upon that. And they shut the group down, and they renamed it ARRO and, you know, got an entirely new team behind it. So that, just one quick example, but there is a lot of conflicting information from the government that really confuses the subject.
UFO and UFOs, it's one of a pet interest of mine, because I like to try to approach it very scientifically, which is very hard to do because it is this thing. And it is something I'm very interested in. I do find it difficult to find avenues where I can explore it and I can ask questions in from a scientific perspective. Mm-hmm. Do you find that in your research, in reaching out to people? Do you find that to be a problem as well?
Well, no, I don't actually. But I think it's just because I have followed the work of, in particularly, Dr. Jacques Vallée. So Jacques Vallée is one of the most important ufologists of our time. He's a French man. He's been in this field for decades. And he's a computer scientist by trade, and he has been putting out scientific papers on the analysis of unidentified objects or pieces thereof since at least the 90s. That was the earliest one I found, but I'm not subscribed to scholarly journal articles. You know, what I was looking for was just what was available on the basic internet. And to be honest, Jacques Vallée led me down a path of looking at other scientists who he was co-authoring papers with. One of those people is Dr. Gary Nolan, who is the professor of pathology at Stanford University. And I believe he still is. Dr. Vallée is a senior. He's an older man. And Dr. Nolan is a younger man. Dr. Nolan, interestingly, I don't know if you're familiar with the Atacama skeleton. That was discovered in, I believe it was 2018. And it was this small, tiny, humanoid, but also extraterrestrial looking skeleton.
Yes.
And there was an uproar saying, is this an alien? Mm. And Dr. Nolan was a skeptic. He wasn't involved in this field at all, but he saw the Atacama skeleton and he said, I'm a professor of pathology at Stanford University. Send the skeleton to me. And if it has any DNA in it, I can analyze it and I can figure out where it came from. They did actually send him the skeleton, and he actually was able to analyze it, and he determined that 98% of the DNA could be sequenced and matched with human DNA. The other 2% were due to just gene sequencing errors that aren't uncommon. And so what it proved was that it was human, it was from this earth, but, you know, had significant genetic deformities. After this, really interestingly, Dr. Nolan began to be contacted by members of the American intelligence community. They began to send him other specimens. Some of these specimens, particularly pieces from unidentified objects, Dr. Nolan was able to perform analysis on, and he began writing journal articles with Dr. Jacques Vallée, on the basis of which formed new ideas for reverse engineering, because they were not able to identify these objects. They were not able to say that they came from this earth. And they're not the only two, but they're the two scientists I'm most familiar with. And the great thing about them, and this is part of the entertainment problem as well, the great thing about scientists like Dr. Vallée and like Dr. Nolan is they try to meet us on the platforms where we're at. So they do podcast interviews. They do YouTube interviews. They go on documentaries. But because the information is presented in a less scientific, less academic way, more accessible to the public, it gets confused with entertainment. Mm. This is fake. This isn't real. In fact, it is very real. And there's journal articles to back it up.
Well, I think that is, in a way, at least for some of these things, the way governing bodies will portray it as like this. Oh, like you don't have to pay attention to this. It's entertainment. It's hoax. It's silly. It's whatever. So it's not only discrediting this one person, but it's discrediting this entire field of study.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is something that I had mentioned at the Cape Breton Paranormal Conference when I was. So the talk I was giving was originally a TEDx talk that I had done at Cape Breton University that unfortunately, I suppose due to its controversial nature, TEDx declined to accept and post on their YouTube channel. So it never went anywhere until I met up with PPRI, which is a local Nova Scotia paranormal group. It's Paranormal Phenomenon Research and Investigations. And they invited me to give the talk again, which was fantastic. So within giving that talk at the paranormal conference and as a TEDx talk, I talk about a couple of acknowledged UFO investigation programs within the American government. One of those programs is AWSAP. So it's AAWSAP, the Aerospace Advanced Weapons Systems Application Program. There was a Defense Intelligence Agency officer from the Pentagon named Dr. James Lukatsky, who was the program manager for this program. It was funded with $22 million of Pentagon money, black money, that is. It was the subject of a 2017 New York Times article. It was groundbreaking at the time because when that article came out, it was the first time a serious publication had actually acknowledged this phenomenon and taken it seriously by reporting on the $22 million that went to funding. So Dr. James Lukacsky from the Pentagon Defense Intelligence Agency, he has spoken out about this program. He has acknowledged that the program has two objectives, or had two objectives, as it's in the past. Those two objectives were, one, to study the performance capabilities of UFOs, and two, to study the effects of UFOs on humans. How do you study the capabilities or effects of something that doesn't exist? To me, that is indirectly the American government admitting that this is a physical reality, and it's something that they spent $22 million to study. Dr. Lukacsky, though, he's really interesting because he still stands by sort of the American national security defense perspective. He's not necessarily a fan of disclosure widely, though he did come out and admit these things as fact. What he also said is that for every special access program, every SAP, of which OSAP was one, there is a disinformation officer assigned to it, every single one. And that officer's entire intent is to confuse the information in the public about that special access program. What lengths they go to do that, I don't know. I'm not privy to that. But we can imagine, right? We can imagine that there are people out there that are directly trying to conflict and confuse the information that comes from programs like this.
What are your thoughts on the disclosure? Just, I kind of am of both minds where we have the right to know, but also I understand that there's a large portion of the population that will not take this very well.
Yep. I am a fan of disclosure, and it's for a number of reasons. The most important of which is because the knowledge of UFOs and UAPs and the related but not mutually exclusive phenomenon of non-human intelligence affects the very notion of life as we know it. It would affect everything we know about science and technology, everything we know about our own origins and about the rest of the universe. And I believe that that's not information that should be held by a small few. I think that every human being deserves to have that knowledge. It's not just about life in the rest of the universe or our own lives on Earth. It actually has to do with the afterlife as well. Several important researchers in this field tend to come up with more questions than answers. And in this field, it can be frustrating because I don't know that our governments actually have all the answers. I actually think that the more they know, the more questions they have versus the more answers, and that can be frustrating. So there's two people in particular that I'm thinking about here who have gone on from the field of studying UFOs to studying evidence for the continuation of consciousness after bodily death. And I think that that is another huge subject that would have big implications for humanity at large. The two people I'm talking about are Robert Bigelow and Leslie Kane. So Robert Bigelow is a really interesting character. He is a billionaire. He owns Budget Suites of America. He is one of the only people I've come across in this field who was interested in it from a young age, like I was. Most people that are in this field, either doing scientific analysis, academic research, or investigative reporting, came at it in indirect ways. They didn't come at it because they were interested in it, but Robert Bigelow always was. And as a child, he had the goal of becoming wealthy so that he could study UFOs on his own. And he actually did that. In 1996, he purchased a place called Skinwalker Ranch in Utah that's known as the epicenter of paranormal activity in the United States. And for 20 years, he did scientific research on Skinwalker Ranch. If you listen to interviews with him, he is very interesting, very shifty. He doesn't come out and say a lot, but there's a lot you can read between the lines. And what he does say is that he had more questions than answers. And I think he sort of gave up on the field and he moved directly into, he opened up the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies. His wife died, which may have had an impact as well on his desire to study this. But the UFO phenomenon is more linked with other paranormal phenomena than anybody is really aware. Some of the phenomena that it's linked with is ghosts and poltergeist. That when there is a UFO sighting, there is more likely to also be so-called poltergeist activity. He moved into that field, which I found fascinating. And there's another key author who moved into that field as well. So Leslie Kane was one of the authors. She, in 2010, wrote a book called UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And the only reason she got into this field is because she received something called the Cometa Report, C-O-M-E-T-A. And that was a report that came out of France and that was sent to her by a colleague. And this report was commissioned by ex-government space and military officials in France, and it took the UFO phenomenon incredibly seriously, and the report detailed what France should do to prepare and protect itself from or around the phenomenon. Leslie Kane took that report really seriously, and she began researching, and that research formed the basis for her book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. The book is incredible because she's only interviewing extremely credible witnesses who have had the bravery and courage to come forward with their stories. Those stories are not uncommon, but the people who come forward are, for a number of reasons. And she comes to the conclusion at the end of her book that UFOs represent a real physical phenomenon. She doesn't draw any conclusions about where it comes from or what it actually is beyond saying that the evidence points to it being a real physical phenomenon. And in 2017, she became one of the two authors of that 2017 article we talked about in the New York Times, breaking open for the first time in major news publication, the UFO story. Leslie Kane also went from investigating UFOs into the related phenomenon of the extension of consciousness after human bodily death. And she wrote a book that I personally found really impactful as somebody who previously identified as agnostic or atheist, called Surviving Death. An investigative reporter investigates evidence for the afterlife. And she looks at a number of different sources, themes in her book. She looks at near-death experiences. She looks at evidence for reincarnation. She looks at psychic mediums. She looks at a whole host of information that you would think is hearsay or otherwise doesn't really have any evidence behind it. And she finds the evidence for it dating back centuries. It's completely fascinating. And there is a Netflix series associated as well that's still on Netflix today called Surviving Death. Leslie Kane is an incredible, highly respected, and credible reporter. And so I know this, you know, I've kind of gone on here, but I think that the UFO phenomenon has far bigger implications for the nature of humanity and the nature of consciousness. And again, I don't think that's something that only a small few deserve to have or know. I think we all deserve to know that information. It impacts every single one of us.